Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope reflects on his visit to Germany. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked back at his state visit last week to his native Germany, saying its theme was a reminder that it is God who gives ultimate meaning to our lives. The lure of shrines. Shrine directors from across Europe are meeting this week at one of England's oldest Marian shrines, and we find out why pilgrimages to these sites are increasingly popular. And a peek at North Korea's silent church. We talked to Lord David Alton from Britain's House of Lords, a longtime Catholic campaigner for human rights in North Korea, about the religious persecution in the reclusive communist state. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked back at his four-day state visit to his native Germany last week, saying the trip's theme, "Where God is, there is a future," reminded us that it is only He who gives ultimate meaning to our lives. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Sono stato felice di vedere che la fede nella mia patria tedesca è molto giovane, che viva.
Faith in my native Germany has a young face. It is alive. It has a future, said Pope Benedict XVI Wednesday, as he retraced the steps of his recent four-day visit to his native land before 20,000 pilgrims in St. Peter's Square for the general audience. They included groups from the church in Indonesia, accompanying their bishops at the beginning of the Ad Limina pilgrimage, from the Samoa Islands in the Pacific, from Kenya, and a children's choir from a South Korean Catholic school. Won a warm smile from Pope Benedict and applause from the crowds as they performed a hymn and traditional dance resplendent in traditional costumes. Young men embarking on their studies for the priesthood at the pontifical colleges, accompanied by their tutors, were also present this Wednesday, for whom the Holy Father had a particular word of encouragement.
My affectionate greeting goes to the students of both the Venerable English College and the Pontifical Irish College, as they take up their studies for the priesthood.
But before these greetings, Pope Benedict XVI had retraced the steps of this historic four-day visit to Germany, his third visit since his election to the pontificate to his homeland, but his first on official state visit to the Federal Republic.
This past weekend, I made an apostolic journey to my native land of Germany, visiting the cities of Berlin, Erfurt, Eichsfeld and Freiburg. The theme of my visit, "Where God is, there's a future," was a reminder that it is God who gives ultimate meaning to our lives and as a source of all good, sustains our efforts to build a just, free, and flourishing society.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict XVI said both his meeting with the federal president and his address to the Bundestag gave him the opportunity to underline how, just as religion requires freedom, freedom also needs religion.
In Berlin, I had the honor of addressing the German parliament, while in Erfurt, a city linked to the memory of Martin Luther, I met the Council of the Evangelical Church in Germany and joined in an ecumenical service of prayer for Christian unity.
Earlier in his catechesis in Italian, Pope Benedict XVI spent greater time reflecting on this second stage of his German visit, his visit to Thuringia, which he said he had particularly wanted to give an ecumenical focus. He said once again in his meeting with members of the Council of the Reformed Protestant Churches in Germany, he saw how important our common witness of faith in Jesus Christ in today's world is, a world which often ignores God or has no interest in him. While, he added, we are also well aware that we can neither make faith nor the unity we so long for. A faith, he said, created by ourselves is of no value, and true unity is rather a gift from the Lord.
At Vespers in Etzelsbach and at Mass in Erfurt, I recall the strong traditions of faith and Christian witness which marks that region, and I urged all to persevere in holiness and to work for the renewal of society.
And then he moved on to Freiburg, and the very festive reception he received from the faithful there.
Finally, at the prayer vigil in the Mass in Freiburg, I encountered the many young people whose faith in Christ gives great hope for the future of the Church in Germany.
Finally, before his return to the Vatican, the Holy Father reflected of how he spoke to 1,000 Catholics involved in the Church and in society in Germany, suggesting some reflections on the action of the Church in a secularized society, reflecting on the invitation for us all, as Catholics, to be free from material and political burdens, to reflect God more transparently.
I thank the choirs, including the children's choir from South Korea, for the praise of God in song. Upon all of you invoke Almighty God's blessings of joy and peace.
And taking his leave from the pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square this Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI returned to his summer residence in the Roman Hills south of the Vatican City State, where he will remain until Saturday, October 1st. I'm Emma McCarthy.
With so much talk about the increasing secularisation of European countries nowadays, it may come as quite a surprise to learn that Catholic shrines in the continent are experiencing a rise in popularity. That's the message that emerged as shrine directors from across Europe began a meeting this week at one of England's oldest Marian shrines, Our Lady of Walsingham in Norfolk. The theme of this week's meeting is Evangelization and Gestures of Popular Piety. And in addition to England, directors have come from France, Portugal, Ireland, Germany, Slovenia, Romania and Poland. This year, the National Shrine of Walsingham is celebrating its 950th anniversary and has had one of its busiest pilgrimage seasons ever. Its director is Father Alan Williams, and I asked him why shrines are growing in popularity, despite our secularised societies in Europe.
Well, I would guess, for a start, the ease and the attraction of transport, but of course also people can arrive at a shrine, in a sense, from nowhere, with no background presumed, no faith background even presumed, and simply slot in and find something there for them in terms of spirituality, in terms of their own faith.
So is this rise in popularity for Catholic shrines sort of across the board, or is it some shrines are attracting more people than others?
When I talk to colleagues, I get the impression that there's a general attraction to Catholic shrines really across the board. And I think shrines have always attracted quite a high percentage of non-practicing Catholics, and certainly even non-Catholics. And I suppose these days, because formal religion and institutional religion seems apparently to be in difficulties, certainly in Europe and in Western Europe, then perhaps it's an attraction that people can simply come to a shrine and take part in what goes on there.
And when you say it has always attracted people who are not Catholic, maybe not even Christian, or who rarely attend church, I mean, what percentage of these, shall we say, non-church people make up the pilgrims who come to your shrine?
I've always reckoned at about 15% for all pilgrimages, but in fact for some pilgrimages, for example, the youth pilgrimages, some of the other pilgrimages, that would actually be a bit higher even. And of course, in Walsingham, we have the additional aspect that there's also an Anglican shrine here, and we would tend to get quite a lot of Anglicans would come in to what we offer, and of course, many of them actually do become eventually Roman Catholics.
And when you talk to these people afterwards, what do they give as their reasons for coming to a shrine?
Highly variable. Sometimes they've heard a friend simply offered them a lift. They've heard there's a coach trip coming to Walsingham. You know, there was lots and lots of reasons for coming. And in a sense, when you ask them what's happened to you here in Walsingham, lots of things have happened to them, but then eventually you come out that there's been some kind of experience with Mary, with Almighty God, with religious faith, and something's reawakened for them.
So plainly, this is an opportunity for the church to evangelise, to reach out to the non-church-going population. How exactly do you do that?
Well, in fact, each year in Walsingham, we have a pilgrim theme, and this year's pilgrim theme has been Our Lady of Walsingham, Witness to the Good News. In other words, it's about evangelisation. Now, actually, we were spurred on to that theme from the Holy Father's visit to England last year when he presented to us all the challenge of evangelisation. How do we do it? Well, in some ways, we presume nothing from some of our pilgrims, and what we hope is that by simply participating in the liturgy here at Walsingham, in what we have to offer in terms of prayer services, devotions, that somehow or other they'll find what they're looking for. And of course, it's also a challenge in terms of homilies that we preach not just to Catholics, but also to people who perhaps are coming in near the church for the first time.
And how common are these cases that you talked about where people, as a result of visiting the shrine, have either become closer to the church if they were already Catholic or have returned to the church if they drifted away or even approaching the church for the first time as non-Catholics?
I would say pretty common, and in a sense, I think, certainly in Walsingham, I'm sure in other shrines, one perhaps measure of that is simply the quality and the number of confessions. The big chapel here in Walsingham is called the Chapel of Reconciliation, and we have daily confessions in that chapel, and certainly somebody who hears confessions every day in Walsingham, I would say that it's quite clear that the grace of God abounds in Our Lady shrines very mightily indeed.
And how is the church planning to make use of, let's say, you know, making pilgrimages to shrines to be incorporated in the drive for a new evangelization, which, as you well know, is going to be the topic of discussion at a Synod of Bishops in the Vatican in 2012?
Indeed, well, the English bishops have already, in fact, been in conversation with the shrine here at Walsingham. And as we explore the new evangelisation, I've actually been asked to do a couple of workshops, meetings for the bishops' conference here in England, simply to explore how shrines can be part of that. Perhaps we can learn from the wider church in England, but I suspect certainly they can learn from our experience here at Walsingham also.
There are, however, people, both within the church and without, who tend to frown somewhat on these gestures of popular piety, visiting shrines and, you know, brand people who travel to them as rather simple, superstitious people looking for miracles. Do you find a lot of evidence of such attitudes?
Not particularly. If I'm honest, not particularly. But again, what I would say to all those people, come and see. I think one thing about shrines of Our Lady, yes, of course, there are processions and devotions and whatever, but you'll actually find also there are lots of quiet places, lots of sacred spaces, and I would say there is something for everybody at shrines of Our Lady.
Sure? Right. I know that this year the Walsingham Shrine is celebrating its 950th anniversary this year. Can you tell us briefly something about its main highlights, how it all began, how, of course, it was suppressed for a while and then restored?
Absolutely. Well, the origins of Walsingham, in a sense, are lost in the mists of time 950 years ago. What we do know is that for centuries it became the preeminent shrine of Our Lady here in England. It had great royal patronage. Lots of people came here, the rich and poor alike. Extremely popular. But of course, in England, we have the sadness of the Reformation and the great persecutions. And about 1538 and afterwards, the shrine here was suppressed. The statue of Our Lady of Walsingham was taken away to London to be publicly burned. And for a long, long time, of course, Catholics were forbidden to come to Walsingham. Catholics were forbidden to practice their faith publicly. But in the 19th century, there was a great gathering in Walsingham that eventually led, of course, to the establishment of the National Shrine here once again in Walsingham.
And on average now, how many pilgrims do you get each year?
Well, it's always difficult to measure. We think about 100,000 a year. And, of course, when you recognise that England is a non-Catholic country, then that's not insignificant. What we can't measure and don't measure are those, if you like, casual visitors and pilgrims that come through the day. But, for example, this year we had our biggest ever pilgrimage in Walsingham for many years, and our numbers vary from a few to actually about 12,000, which, of course, logistically is quite a problem on our quite small site.
Right. Looking at the wider picture within Europe, Lourdes is by far the most popular Marian shrine in terms of numbers within Europe. But after that, which others attract very large numbers of pilgrims?
Well, the gathering here in Walsingham of the shrine directors, we have, of course, some of the great shrines, some of the much smaller shrines, and the obvious shrines in terms of numbers who will be here this week, of course, Lourdes, Fatima, Knock. But there are also much smaller shrines. And the nice thing is that we can all of us gather together, in fact, under the chair of the Bishop of Lourdes, and then discuss common experiences and pull some new ideas together.
And do you find you get a lot of new ideas in these annual meetings?
Absolutely. I mean, we have the formal business sessions, but of course a lot of this meeting is about networking, about talking to each other, and about simply being together.
So, all things being equal, do you foresee or continue to foresee a rosy future for shrines? They'll continue to attract large numbers of pilgrims, wherever they may be?
I think that certainly in Europe, pilgrimage is, if I may put it like this, a growing business. More and more people are making their ways to shrines, and I think the church, the challenge to the church is how to welcome them and, of course, how to evangelise them.
I was speaking to Father Alan Williams, Director of the Shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham in Eastern England. History was made this month as a delegation of leaders from the major religions made a four-day visit to the reclusive communist state of North Korea. The delegation was led by the Catholic Archbishop of Gwangju in South Korea, Kim Dae-jung, and included leading representatives of other Christian denominations, Buddhism, Confucianism, and other faiths. Their visit marked the first time leaders of major religions have made a joint trip to North Korea, a nation where religious freedom is denied. Archbishop King said their visit was aimed at helping bring the two Koreas onto a path of reconciliation and cooperation. It took place during the week that the Catholic Church celebrates the memory of the Korean martyrs, between 8 and 10,000 men and women who died for their faith in the 19th century. Lord David Alton is a Catholic member of the British House of Lords and a long-time campaigner for human rights in North Korea. He spoke to Emma McCarthy just before he travelled to North Korea to deliver a lecture at a Pyongyang university.
It's significant that in this week of the Feast of the Korean Martyrs, the Universal Church was celebrating the memory of perhaps between 8 and 10,000 people who died for their faith, mainly in the 19th century in Korea, notably St. Andrew Kim, who was the first Korean to be ordained a priest and who was executed at the age of 25. It's significant that to this very day, there are still in North Korea some 300,000 people in the camps there, according to the United Nations. Many of them are held as prisoners because of their political or their religious beliefs. 2 million people died in North Korea during the famine in the 1990s, and the most recent reports are pointing once again to malnutrition and stunted growth, according to our own British ambassador, who's based in Pyongyang. He's seen first-hand accounts of that. I'll be speaking in North Korea at an interesting new university called Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. It's interesting because it's the very first public private university. It's interesting because it's been founded by a South Korean Christian and who was initially sentenced to be executed by the North Koreans and then was invited back. a man who, in the Korean War, when some 3 million people died, saw almost all of the 800 people in his unit die. He made a pledge that if he survived, and he was only one of eight who did survive, that one day he would try to do something for peace in North Korea. And he then went back, and Dr. James King Kim created this university. I visited it last year, and there are now 600 students there being taught in English. So in a situation that's full of darkness, it's nice to be able to report that there is at least one little glimmer of hope, and that maybe that will, in years to come, help to transform the situation in that country.
In fact, as you pointed out, there have been over 10,000 martyrs in the Korean church, but the Korean church is also one of the fastest growing churches in Asia. It's, you know, tripled the number of Christians, the number of baptized Christians within the last 10 years. How would you, as someone who's been there and witnessed the church both in the north, for what it's worth, and in the south, how would you describe it?
Well, in the north, under the surface, it reminds me a little bit of the English Catholic Church during penal times, where people thought they'd wiped out Catholicism, but it was there beneath the surface, waiting for the day for the Catholic spring, as Cardinal John Henry Newman put it in the 19th century, the day in which it could flower again. And I was struck in a place called Onju, about 60 kilometres north of Pyongyang, when I asked the mayor there if there were any churches, and she said they were all destroyed during the Korean War. And I said, well, are there any believers? And she said, yes, there was a Catholic church here, and people still meet in the rubble of that building. And I said, what, every week? And she said, every week. And of course, there have been no priests permitted into the country in 60 years. And during my last visit, I was also allowed to visit the one authorised Catholic church building, which is in Pyongyang. A service was held there, and this time they allowed me to speak to the congregation. And I had the chance to give them greetings from the Universal Church, and I said I knew that they were very much in the heart and the mind of Pope Benedict, and that we're all waiting for the day when the North Korean church again will be allowed to come out from the catacombs. It's a silent church at the present time. And when you look beyond the 38th parallel into South Korea, you see an extraordinary church. You see a church that is expanding. About 12% of South Koreans are now Catholic. It's the biggest missionary church outside of the United States in the world. The Koreans are the most amazing people, and they bring great love and they bring great dignity and enthusiasm in witnessing for their faith. I visited the brand new Catholic hospital. It's the biggest in the country, in Seoul, doing a brilliant job. The Catholic University, the schools there, they provide a huge amount of the social infrastructure. But they were also, as emerged in the obituaries of Cardinal Kim, they were also the reason why democracy came about in South Korea. And Koreans haven't forgotten that, that when the tanks arrived and the demonstrators and the protesters calling for democracy sheltered in the Catholic cathedral, the cardinal stood at the doors and said, you can have the protesters, but first you come over me, and then over the fathers, and then over the sisters, and then you can have them. And it broke the determination of the military regime to persist, and that's how democracy emerged in South Korea. So the church in Korea has an amazing record. I hope that the next Youth Day, International World Youth Day, which was so important in Madrid this year, I hope that maybe the next one will be in Asia, and we're better than Seoul. I think it would be a great thing for everybody if young Catholics from around the world were able to go to Seoul, but also it would be a wonderful affirmation of the silent church in the north of Korea and an affirmation of this really energetic church in the south.
In fact, the Lay Congress by the Pontifical Council for the Laity was held most recently last August, not August gone, but August 2010, in Korea, and drew together all the churches and lay workers within the church in Asia, and really was a very vital and vibrant congress. Your love for Korea and for the Korean church, where does it come from, first of all? And secondly, have we got something to learn, we here in the modernised, developed, secularised world?
Well, we have a lot to learn. It was Tertullian, wasn't it, who said the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. And I think the real suffering and sacrifices that people have made for their faith is deeply inspiring to people like me. And I think we in the West who take our liberties and freedoms so much for granted. So the Korean church has a lot to say to us at any number of levels. But I think it's, for me, it wasn't that I started off by having knowledge about Korea, or even that I thought this was something I could do anything about. But a young man came through London who'd escaped from North Korea, and he was due to meet a colleague of mine, and she was away from London at the time, and someone from her office telephoned me and said, would I see him instead? And I said, but I don't know anything about North Korea. And they said, well, no one knows much about North Korea, so that's all right. Will you see him? And I said, okay, we'll bring him in. And I met this young man, and he explained to me how his wife and two children had died during the famine. And then as he attempted to leave the country across the River Yalu into China, he lost his other son, went back for him and found him dead as well. He lost everybody. And he has been going in and out of North Korea ever since, like a Korean Ralph Ullenberg, helping people to escape through the underground railway, as it's called, that operates through house churches in China, enabling people to get out of North Korea. His story I found so inspiring, but I felt it needed a wider hearing. And I didn't know what I could do for him. I explained I wasn't the government, and I started telling him all the things I'm not. And I thought, this won't do. So I said, look, I'll tell your story in Parliament. I'll find a way of trying to get a debate about the situation. And so I called a debate, and our name came up in the ballot that we had, and it was about the security and human rights situation in North Korea. And I told his story. And as a result of that, the North Koreans protested. Their ambassador in London rang me and said, I've been listening to too many Americans. And I said, I've not spoken to any Americans, but I've spoken to a North Korean. Who was that? He said. And I said, well, I can't tell you who it was. Obviously, I wasn't going to tell him that. But I said, I tell you, it's a North Korean who's told me about the situation in the country. I said, but you can come and tell me your side of the story, which he did. And then in the course of it, I said, well, how could anyone verify if anything you've said is true when you don't allow people into the country? And he said, well, would you go? And I wondered, yes, but would I come back? But I said, yes, I'll go. And I persuaded my colleague, Lady Cox, Baroness Cox, to come with me. And we took a young man, James Maudsley, a young Catholic, who had been in Burma and spent 18 months in solitary confinement in prison because of his human rights work there. He came as our secretariat, and we wrote a report, and we created a parliamentary North Korea group when I returned, and I was elected as chairman of that 7 years ago. And since then, we've held a lot of hearings in Parliament where we've given people the chance to come and tell their individual stories. But we've also done what I wrote in the visitor's book at the 38th parallel. I said, it's better for men to build bridges than to build walls. That's what we've been trying to do, a process of constructive but critical engagement, being affirmative where we can, being in dialogue and trying to build some kind of process of reconciliation, but also insisting that there are non-negotiables as well. And some of those include an absolute belief in human rights, that every person is made in the image of God. And on the back of that come certain liberties and freedoms as enunciated in the 1948 Declaration on Human Rights, one of which is the right to life, but another of which is the right to freedom of worship and freedom of religious expression. So my hope is, and again in this week, when religious leaders from South Korea have been permitted to North Korea, a group of them went together to North Korea, my hope is that we're beginning to see some kind of change. And it would be nice to think that as a result of that young man's visit those 7 years ago, that maybe that's been a small part of the process.
That was British Catholic peer Lord David Alton speaking to Emma McCarthy. That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.